The song is called Distant Lonesome Train, the latest release by blues master Joe Bonamassa. The story of the court battle over the so-called Mormon will was one of the biggest in Las Vegas history. It's front page news here. After all, Howard Hughes had played such a huge role in moving the mob out of Las Vegas, bringing our city into the modern financial world. Wall Street paid attention. Hughes was the biggest employer in the state of Nevada. I was not a reporter at the time when the trial played out in probate court here, but I followed the story for many years, got to know Melvin Dumar many years ago. He's the guy who had this encounter with a disheveled, beaten up old man in the middle of the Nevada desert back in 1967, setting off a mystery that is still unfolding. A retired FBI agent named Gary Magnuson started digging into the case some years ago and is continuing to overturn rocks and find new evidence, new witnesses. The sum total of his work paints a much different picture than what was decided in court all those years ago. In a moment, Gary Magnuson joins us to talk about his new book, Stolen Justice. And then a little bit later, Melvin Dumar will be here to join us. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. There are a lot of people out there who consider Melvin Dumar to be a fraud, a criminal, a money grubber, but Gary Magnuson is not among them. He's a retired FBI agent who became interested in the story of Melvin Dumar and his encounter with Howard Hughes in the Nevada desert and launched his own investigation into not only their meeting, but also the validity of the handwritten Howard Hughes will, the so-called Mormon will that was tested in court. The last time we spoke to Gary Magnuson, he had his first book about this case had come out, and it led to additional hearings in federal court. It looks like that door is now closed forever, but he's still working on the case. And Gary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Since it looks like the legal door is closed forever, we could say that you're not out to try to get a new trial or a new hearing. You're doing this for the sense of justice.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, an interesting thing is that the last time I was on the program, we got a number of people that called in and actually added to this story. They had information that was not available prior to that. So I can give credit to your program here, Coast to Coast, and to helping out with this thing.
Well, good. Maybe we'll get some more from tonight's story. Your new book is it's very powerful. It makes a very powerful case in favor of Melvin's story. You start with a burglary, and I had never heard this before. I've covered this for a long time and dug into it myself. I had never heard the story of this burglary. Tell that and how it relates.
Well, the probate trial was held in Las Vegas. It ran 8 months. It may very well have been the longest probate trial in the United States history. It started in 1977 and ran into 1978. Because of a lot of the shenanigans that took place during the trial, there were those that supported Melvin's position who believed, and I believe the same, that one of the jurors, as a matter of fact, the foreman of the jury, was bribed. And this individual hired a burglar to break into the law office of where he believed these records were kept regarding the bribery of this juror. And it's kind of a twisted story, but in essence, what happened was he called the person that hired him to do this and told him that he had found these records, but the records were never delivered. And before long, this individual was murdered. Now, the best information I could obtain was that he was either killed in Los Angeles or San Francisco. And I contacted the cold case homicide detectives in both cities, and we were not able to run it down. We don't have the victim's name, and that's the biggest problem, because most of their cases are filed by name. But so this burglary took place, and apparently someone hired another person to kill this person because he had these records.
And before he was killed, he was beaten up, right?
Yeah, he was beaten up, put in the hospital, and threatened. I guess they wanted the records. And the problem is, I don't know exactly how he was killed, where he was killed, or who killed him. But I have it from several sources that this took place.
So as an FBI agent, I mean, you're used to tracking this kind of stuff down. You talk to people. You talk to them often off the record, sort of like a journalist does.
Right, right.
And how did you find out about the burglary? You have it from multiple sources.
Yeah, they were aware of it after the fact. As a matter of fact, I spoke to the person that hired the burglar to do the break-in. By the way, it was Oscar Goodman's office. Oscar Goodman was a famous, well, still is, famous mob attorney in Las Vegas and a two-term mayor of Las Vegas.
Three-term. Yeah, three terms, yeah.
Yeah, three terms, okay. And, yeah, so, but I was not able to track it down. The murder cases are filed by either case number, date of murder, or the victim's name. And so without those specific facts, the homicide divisions in San Francisco and Los Angeles could not trace down who the victim was.
Is there one thing that got you hooked on Melvin's story and made you believe that he was telling the truth? Or it's a whole bunch of things, I know, but is there anything in particular that really grabbed you in the beginning?
Well, you know, I kind of did some preliminary things, but when I first interviewed Melvin, this was in 2004, I believe it was, and he was seriously ill. He had cancer, and they had gone through radiation and chemotherapy, neither of which had done anything, and so the last resort was that they would give him a bone marrow transplant. And so when I interviewed him, he was in the process of going through that, and he told me that he just wanted people to know the truth. After all of these years, when everybody made fun of him and disparaged him, he just wanted someone to objectively look into it. And I thought to myself, now here's a man that was made fun of because he came out and said that he had picked up Howard Hughes in the desert. And his life was ruined because of it. No one would hire him. You know, he was the laughingstock almost nationally. And I thought, here he is. He's probably going to die of cancer fairly soon. And yet he wants to reopen this wound, more or less, and start all over again with this process. And I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why would he want to do that? And so I began to think, well, maybe there's something to it. Now, initially, all I knew about him was that, you know, what I lived in Milwaukee at the time all of this came down, so there wasn't a lot of news about it. But what I had read was that basically he was kind of a kook and was one of these people that dreams up these things and so on. But as I got into it further and further, I determined, no, he's not a kook. He made some mistakes, there's no doubt about that. But as I dug deeper and deeper into this, I came to believe that he is absolutely telling the truth.
Give me the broad strokes of what you cover in the book, because it starts with this burglary, the idea that there is evidence somewhere that the members of the jury that made a decision about the validity of the handwritten Howard Hughes will had been bribed. But in addition to those stories, which had been floating around and still are floating around, you know, you got a lot of corroboration for that, not only about the burglary, but about the contents of that office. But in addition, there was intimidation of witnesses, threats.
Yes.
beatings. It has the hallmark of a well-funded conspiracy.
Absolutely, there's no question about it. And you had the two sides. You had the people that said the will was actually Howard Hughes's will, and then you had the people opposing that. Well, the opposition to the will were extremely well-funded. They had a lot of money to put into this thing, and they were, of course, playing for very, very high stakes here. You're talking about the estate of the first American billionaire, and so not only did they hire the best attorneys, but they also were involved in jury tampering, I determined, witness intimidation, obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, and some other things, including help from the then Nevada Attorney General, Robert List.
Who became governor.
And he was the Attorney General. He was appointed as the friend of the court to assist the court with legal matters and running down evidence and so on and so forth. And he went after Melvin Dumas from the very beginning. It was his intent to prosecute Melvin, and they did absolutely everything they could possibly do to bring charges against Melvin for fraud and so on. Well, they were unable to do that. But during this whole trial episode, and even after, they were after Melvin. And then we determined through records that Mr. List had received $26,000 contributions from Summa Corporation. And that was the corporation that took control of Howard Hughes' properties and businesses after he passed away. And so Mr. List received $26,000 for his gubernatorial campaign from the opponents of the will.
I was surprised. I had never read these comments, but comments that you have in the book from the judge who presided over this trial and what he thought about the decision.
Yes.
Why don't you share that with us?
Well, he had written two findings because he was unsure of how it would come out. So he had one, if the jury found that the will was legitimate, and then he had another one, if the jury found that it was illegitimate. Plus, he said later on that he was certain that it was actually Howard Hughes' will. But unfortunately, the jury didn't see it that way for a number of reasons, some of which I've already talked about as far as the jury tampering and so on and so forth. The jury foreman, during the trial, not only did they take notes like most juries do, but he would go home every night and he would retype his notes. And I talked to his son. This man has passed away, but I spoke with his son, and he showed me the typewritten pages. There were 155 pages of typewritten material. I spoke with the man's wife and asked her if he ever planned on writing a book. She says, absolutely not. And I asked, well, why did he take those notes? Well, I don't know. And then when I spoke with his son about it, he said, well, a man had approached him and said that we would like to make a movie. So make good notes, and then we will talk to you after the trial is over. Well, they never talked to him again. And I believe firmly that what they did was have him rewrite the notes and maybe twist the evidence a little bit in his particular notes. And in speaking with another member of the jury, they chose this man to be the foreman because he had these notes. And when they deliberated, they relied quite a bit on his particular notes. Now, in talking with Judge Mendoza, I believe is his name. He was a judge at the time, not for this trial, but he was a judge in Clark County. And he said that this was very, very not only unusual, but would never have been allowed. If the judge would have known that this was taking place, the juror would have been dismissed, because you can't redo the evidence and then present it to the jury afterwards.
Do you think, Gary, that Melvin Dumar could have produced this will if he had wanted to defraud the estate or pull this off?
No. There are so many reasons why he could not have. And I could go down the list.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk things. About the will a little bit, the so-called Mormon will.
Yes.
When Melvin joins us a little bit later, we'll describe the circumstances of how it surfaced and how it was delivered to him. But this three-page handwritten note, legal pad, which is what Howard Hughes wrote on a lot, why do you think it's legit?
Because of all of the various things that that came up. Number one, Howard Hughes moved to Las Vegas on Thanksgiving of 1966. He lived on the ninth floor, the penthouse of the Desert Inn, and he stayed there until Thanksgiving of 1970. He eventually bought that casino hotel, and he had the whole top ninth floor, which was the penthouse floor. And during that time period, and I have this from those men who were his personal aides, he always wrote on yellow paper. He always used a Papermate pen. When the will was studied at the FBI laboratory, they determined that that particular ink used was a very particular type of ink, and it was only used by Papermate, and it was only used during a short period of time. I can't remember exactly, but it was a 3 or 4 year period where this particular ink was used, and it was during this time frame. The will was dated 1968, and how could Melvin Dumar know that he, number one, used yellow paper, number two, that he only used Papermate pens? There was the envelope that the will was in was stamped by a Pitney Bowes stamp machine, and it showed a Las Vegas stamp. The number on the stamp was from Pitney Bowes' machine that had been sold to the Desert Inn. How did Melvin get a hold of that? How could he insert that envelope and stamp it from that particular machine? When Melvin picked up this old man in the desert, and he'll talk more about this, but in essence, he found an old man, underweight, long hair, long beard, wearing old-fashioned type clothes. How did he know that's exactly what Howard Hughes looked like at that particular time?
Yeah, because the public had no idea that's what Hughes looked like.
No idea whatsoever. The only people that had face-to-face contact with him were those aides that were around him. No one else knew what he looked like at that point in time. And Melvin described him to a T. And there are a number of other things too, but there's a whole list that I set out in my book of things that pinpoint exactly to what we're talking about, that Melvin could never have known about these things. It would be impossible.
Well, Melvin made some mistakes, which he has certainly admitted over the years, that caused him some problems when this whole thing came to court, and which have contributed to ongoing problems for him. But he perseveres, and he will join us in just a couple of minutes. Melvin Dumar will be joining my guest, Gary Magnuson, to talk about the events that fateful night in 1967 and the Hughes fortune and what became of it. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Joni Mitchell takes us into the break. Michigan rocker Bob Seger brings us back into the program. 1967, just south of the Cottontail Ranch in central Nevada, driving along in the middle of the night, Melvin Dumar pulls off the side of the road and finds a beaten, disheveled old man laying in the dirt. He wakes the guy up, gives him a ride back to Las Vegas. They have a conversation along the way, and the old guy claims he's Howard Hughes. Melvin doesn't think much about that. He gets kind of a chuckle about it, drops the guy off near the Sands Hotel, gives him some change from his pocket, and then forgets about it. And 10 years later, Melvin Dumar is the star of an 8-month-long legal battle that the whole world was watching here in Las Vegas, a probate battle over the legitimacy of the so-called Mormon will, handwritten by Howard Hughes on 3 pages of legal pad, in which Melvin Dumar is named a beneficiary. At the time, Hughes was worth about $2 billion. He was the richest man in America. And Melvin's cut would have been something like $158 million. I got to know Melvin some years ago. We went up to Utah, where he was living at the time, and did an interview and a couple of news stories. Then a year or so after that, he came down to Las Vegas. We went back out to the site and located the spot, the very spot where he found Howard Hughes, and he showed us what the condition of the guy was and how he was laying at the time. We did it for a TV program. And then last year, I caught up with Melvin. He's now moved to Pahrump, Nevada. He's living out there, is doing pretty well, and we told the story again. Well, now we get to update the story. Some of it you may have heard before, some of it you haven't heard, and Melvin Dumar joins us in just a moment. Welcome back to Coast to Coast, and welcome back to Melvin Dumar. Melvin, how you doing? Life is good for you out there.
Well, yeah, I'm getting by. Actually, I'm getting into real estate. I just passed all the tests and everything to get my Nevada real estate license, so I'm kind of excited about that.
Awesome, good. Do people still, do they recognize you? Do they stop and say, "Hey, I believe you," or "I don't believe you," or does it still come up?
It's kind of slowed down, you know, in the last few years, but it used to happen all the time.
I know that you've told this story a lot of times, and I'm not going to ask you to tell the whole thing again, but I just would like you to give me an abbreviated version of the night that you encountered Howard Hughes in the desert. You're driving south toward Las Vegas, and you just passed the Lida Junction. What happens?
Well, I was off work. It was given a week or so off work. I was working up in Gabs, and I'd had a motorcycle wreck 2 days before that, and they told me to take a few days off until I healed up. And so I was on my way to Southern California to try to reconcile with my ex-wife, and just past the Cottontail Ranch, there was approximately 5 miles. It was in the middle of the night because I didn't leave Gabs until it was dark already. And so it was somewhere around midnight on the 29th of December, 1967. And I pulled off the road to relieve myself. I saw a small dirt road, and I pulled off there approximately 100 yards off the highway. And there was this old man just laying there, and I thought I'd found a dead body. So I was contemplating whether I should go back into Goldfield and get the sheriff or not. And then I seen him move, and he was trying to get up. And so I was quite relieved that whoever it was wasn't actually dead. So I went over and helped him up and got him in my car and asked him if he wanted to go to a doctor or a hospital or get a hold of the sheriff. And he didn't want anything to do with, you know, police or hospitals or doctors or anything. All he wanted to do is go back to Vegas. He said that's where he wanted to go. And I said, well, I'm going down that way. I'd be glad to give you a ride if you want. So I took him down to Las Vegas and dropped him off behind the Sands Hotel. And that's where he wanted to go. So that's where I took him.
And you're having a conversation with him during the drive, and he tells you at some point that he's Howard Hughes.
Oh, yeah, he told me who he was, and I'd heard of Howard Hughes, but I had no clue to run into him.
And I didn't really take him seriously. I thought he was a bum or a wino or something, you know, out there, and, you know, just prospector or some darn thing out there in the middle of nowhere. It was kind of strange because it was cold that night, and he was hurt. He looked like he had blood on the side of his face and on his shirt and stuff, and he wouldn't tell me how he got there or what he was doing there or anything. So I just took him into Vegas, and when he left me, of course, he told me, you know, who he was and everything. But when he left me, another reason I thought he was a bum is because he asked if I had any money, and I said, well, yeah. And so I gave him some change, and he got out of the car, and he seemed to be okay when I dropped him off. I mean, when I picked him up, I think he was almost froze to death. When I dropped him off, it was a couple hours or more later, yeah, he walked away from the car, and I just left. I headed for California.
In the movie, Melvin and Howard, you guys are singing a couple of your songs. Did that happen?
Yes, I did. I do remember singing a song to him. You know, it wasn't the one that you have in the movie, but yes, I do remember singing a song. And actually, the name of the song that I was singing is one that I wrote. It's called "The Dream Can Become a Reality." And it was kind of ironic that would come up.
So the reason it came up that he's Howard Hughes is you were talking to him about job. You had tried to find a job at one point with Hughes.
Yeah, I was in the Air Force, and when I first got out of the Air Force, I wanted to go to work in the aircraft industry. In fact, I wanted to be a pilot, and I kind of talked to him about that a little bit. But I tried to get a job at Hughes Aircraft in Fullerton, California. And, you know, I didn't get hired there, and so I got a job as a milkman instead.
Yeah, he's at some point, I guess, in Gary's book, he says, you mentioned about trying to get a job there, and he says, oh, I can help you with that.
Oh yeah, that's actually when he told me that who he was. He said, well, if you need a job, you know, he said, I could arrange that, I think is the way he said it, and he said, because I own it. And I thought, boy, this guy is really weird.
And he asked you a couple of times to for your last name, as if he was trying to memorize it?
Well, I don't know. He asked me several times. I don't know exactly how many times he, you know, and I got the impression. I said, well, geez, I just told you what my name was. Why are you asking me again? You know, because I told him, you know, several times. He was asking, you know, what I was doing, where I was at working, and you know, what my name was. And so I repeated myself several times to him.
Gary Magnuson, you did what an FBI agent does, is you went back and tried to verify as many of these details as told by Melvin that you could. For example, you confirmed that he was, in fact, you got employment records. He was off. He was injured, and he was off those days. And the timing is critical to the story, right?
That's absolutely right. I was involved in a lot of criminal cases that went to trial, and what you try to do is corroborate through different evidence the witness's testimony. And so that's exactly what I did. And I believe that the original trial, the probate trial, could have turned out differently if they would have had a couple of competent investigators to dig up this stuff at that time instead of when I had to do it many, many years later. But after I met with Melvin up at that site, south of Lida Junction, it dawned on me that the only sign of civilization in that whole area was the Cottontail Ranch brothel. There is nothing else in that area. And so I thought, well, you know, if it's this close to the Cottontail, I ought to go over there and make some inquiries. And that's what I did. That's one of the steps I took. And it opened a whole new vista as far as the investigation went.
Well, I mean, you did confirm Melvin's details, and if he were telling a lie, that's the kind of thing that would trip him up.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And in addition, you verified a lot of the other part of the equation. That is, the idea, there are several indications, in addition to witnesses that we'll talk about in a bit, several indications that Howard Hughes was not in the Desert Inn at that same time frame when this was supposedly taking place.
That's right. You know, during the trial, both sides put on handwriting experts. In speaking with the juror that was on that jury, he said that the jury basically discounted the handwriting because it basically canceled out, because the handwriting experts on either side opposed each other's position on the handwriting, and so they canceled that out. And what they based their decision on, that this was not a legitimate will, was the testimony of Howard Hughes' personal aides. And they all testified that Howard Hughes never left the DI during the time that he lived in Las Vegas. That was for 4 years. He never left the Desert Inn. And so I was able to break that down and determine this. Yes, indeed, he was out of the Desert Inn on a number of occasions.
And what are the indications that there was a different level of activity at the DI on the night that we're talking about?
The person that I have now determined was behind Howard Hughes sneaking out of the DI when no one else was aware of it was a man by the name of Howard Eckersley. And he always was the one that was working at the shift when Howard Hughes left. And I've corroborated that through a number of ways, through other witnesses and some records. I was able to dig up the records of the shift for that particular week, the week of the 29th of December, 1967. And he worked that night. And then later on, of course, we come up with these other witnesses that confirmed that he was actually out of the Desert Inn, and now we know exactly where he was during that time period, and it explains exactly why Melvin found him in the desert.
Melvin, back to you. Tell me about the day that somebody delivers this envelope that changed your life. You had already heard or read about Howard Hughes dying. The story had been all over the world by then. But somebody shows up. Describe the events of that day.
Well, I had a little gas station mini market there in Willard, Utah. And a guy walked in there, and I was actually going to Weber State College at the time. And I was working on, you know, one of my assignments, and this guy walked in and started asking me questions about Howard Hughes, you know, if I'd ever met him and things like that. And I thought, well, this is strange. And I think I told him that I found this old man that claimed to be Hughes a few years earlier, but I think it was actually about 9 or 10 years earlier, because this was in 76, and I picked him up in 67, I guess about 9 years. And then he asked me, he made comments, that wouldn't it be nice if someone like you was in his will? And I thought, well, you know, hell, I know I'm not in his will. I mean, you know, I helped the guy, said he was used, but that would be impossible. And then some other customers came in, so I went to help them. This guy was still in the station, and when I got done with these other customers, I walked back in, and the guy was gone. I didn't know where he went or how he left or anything. I just didn't see him leave. And but when I went back over to my school books, right on top of them, right, you know, where I had them open, there was this envelope that was addressed to the president of the Mormon Church. And I I picked it up and I said, what the heck, how'd this get here, you know? And I thought, well, there's only been one person here. And so I kind of went out to see if I could see where he went, and, you know, he was gone. I didn't know where he went or where he came from or anything. But later on, during the trial, this guy from Anchorage, Alaska, named Levain Forsythe, said that he was the one that brought it to me. I actually went up to Anchorage. I guess the attorneys was testing me, and I went up to Anchorage with them. The first thing they did, they gave me a magazine. I think it was Alaskan Steel or something, and they told me to look through it and see if there was anybody I recognized. And God, there was about 150 people in the book, and I went through it. It took me a couple of times, you know, and because I thought it would be somebody right in the foreground, I didn't recognize anybody, and they said, well, look through it again, and then I seen him. He was the same guy that came to my station. He was kind of in the background, you know, behind other people, and I said, well, there's the guy that came to my station, and it was him. Later, they brought him in to the captain, I think it's Captain Hook or Captain Cook Motel there in Anchorage, and it was Levain Forsythe, and he just walked right up to me and started talking and asked me how everything was going. I said, Jesus, this is kind of a coincidence, you know.
And Gary Magnuson, in the book Stolen Justice, you fill in a lot of the blanks about Levain Forsythe and the key role he plays in Melvin's story.
Yeah, he was an absolute key figure. If we go back to when Howard Hughes was making movies in Los Angeles, he was a big movie producer, was very successful at it, as a matter of fact. And they were making a movie, I can't remember exactly where it was, Van Nuys or someplace, I don't remember. But anyway,
Ventura.
A man came, where was it?
Ventura.
Okay, Ventura. And a man comes up to him and says, you know, Mr. Hughes, after everybody goes home for the night, they're stealing stuff off the set here. And so he thanked him for that. And Hughes was the kind of man, he didn't have a lot of personal friends or contacts, but when he found someone that he liked, he trusted them almost immediately. And so he hired this guy, Levain Forsythe, as kind of his, I don't know what you want to call
bag man.
Yeah, bag man, secret courier, and so on and so forth. And Forsythe admitted that he took a lot of money from Hughes to pay politicians and different things so that Hughes could get whatever he wanted. And so he used him for a number of years. And then Hughes approached Forsythe and said, look, I've got a will here. And he gave him a large envelope. This is the envelope that I mentioned earlier that was stamped on the Pitney Bowes machine in the DI.
I'll tell you what, we'll come back to this. You have a 2,800 other reasons why you believe the Levain Forsythe story. The Atlanta Rhythm section takes us into the break. We continue our conversation with Gary Magnuson and Melvin Dumar right after this on Coast to Coast AM.